Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com.
We are an associate of the Commons Project Network. You can find us at www.thecommonsprojectnetwork.com.
The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander, and once again, I'd like to welcome our listeners to The Socialist Insight. And today we have Alan Mackey. He's joining the program once again. He comes on every other week, and he help us to explore various topics that are very relevant to the left. And today we are dealing with a very important topic, dealing with minimum wage and much of the debate that has been centered around that particular subject. And Alan, once again, I would like to welcome you to the program today.
Well, thanks for having me again, Stuart.
Alan, you've been posting a great deal of information in regards to minimum wage, and we can see the tremendous impact that it have on our youth, on working families, on seniors. And for the most part, we can see that the minimum wage that we have in this country is very ineffective when it comes to taking care of the needs of working people. And when we look at the first attempts that they had at establishing a minimum wage in this country was in 1933, and that was with the National Industrial Recovery Act. And at the time, it came under much criticism and under attack from both sides of the aisle because they thought that raising the minimum wage was going to be devastating to the economy. And then in 1938, it did pass, and in the passed under the Fair Labor Standards Act under FDR. And the amount that it increased at that time, the minimum wage went to 25 cents an hour. Now, even though they said it was going to have devastating effects on the economy, actually it didn't have any devastating effects on the economy. But, Alan, we have heard that same age-old argument for more than three-quarters of a century. Why is it that we in this country, when it comes to, and I'm talking about in this economy, that talking about a minimum or decent income for working families, why is it always on the, people come out and go on the attack against a fair minimum wage for working people?
Well, the main reason is because there's people that profit from the business community profits from paying workers a poverty wage. The less you pay workers, the more profits are going to be. So the objective of the business class of people, the Wall Street people, is to pay people as low wage as possible. Many of these people want to get rid of the minimum wage completely because they think they should be able to pay people even less than what the minimum wage is. I might point out one thing, Stuart. You know, most people, their idea behind working is so that they work so they're not poor. And I think this is an important point that a lot of people miss. In fact, I miss it a lot of times myself in talking to people about this, because people work because they don't want to be poor. This is a basic fact of life. And as far as the minimum wage hurting the economy, this needs to really be looked at, because during the Depression and during recessions, the best thing that can happen to any economy is that the minimum wage is raised, because when working people have money in their pockets, especially the poorest among working people, they spend all their money. They don't save any of it, and they spend it on things that they need. And that puts people to work creating and building and manufacturing the things that people are buying. So this helps the economy. What doesn't help the economy is a bunch of rich people hoarding this wealth. When we see that we have these Fortune 400 billionaires on the Forbes 400 list that have so much wealth, I mean, it's obscene wealth that they've accumulated and hoarded now, And much of that wealth is based on the minimum wage. Some of those people on that Forbes 400 list are some of the worst offenders when it comes to paying people the minimum wage or even less than the minimum wage. There's two people here in Minnesota that are on that list, and they made their billions of dollars in the hospitality industry. And this is an industry that is known for hiring a lot of people that are undocumented workers, and they pay people less than the minimum wage, and they treat them like crap. So, you know, these people are making a lot of lots and lots of profits off of paying people poverty wages, and this isn't right.
Now, I noticed in this, you put out several articles, and I definitely agree with everything that you just said there, Alan. But you had just mentioned in this one article, and you put out articles from time to time, and I find them very interesting. But one of the things I noticed is you gave a breakdown in regards to many of the things that we have to deal with every day, even when we have to go and buy a loaf of bread in the market, or if we have to go and purchase a gallon of milk, peanut butter, or pay for rent. These are things we have to deal with every day. And you had mentioned that Richard Trumka, the president of the AFL-CIO, hailed Jerry Brown's increasing the minimum wage in California to $10 an hour. But we need to read the small print, $10 per hour, beginning in 2015. Before I get into the breakdown, because I want to get into this breakdown, but share a little bit about that $10 an hour that Governor Brown just signed into law here in California.
Okay, well, it's an incremental increase beginning, I believe, in 2014 at $9 and something an hour, and then it goes up.
25 cents.
Yeah, and then it goes up to $10 an hour in 2016. And, 2016, right. And
right, I see you, right. In 3 years, 2016, you're right.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, anybody with any common sense knows that people living in California, I've never even been to California myself, but I know a number of people that live in California, and they tell me that,
including,
you know,
myself.
When I talk, I know that the prices of basic necessities of life, including food and rent and gas and everything else, is much higher in California than what it is here in Minnesota or Wisconsin or Michigan. So, you know, one thing these politicians will never talk about is cost of living and standard of living. And these are the things that working people are going to have to start throwing out in their faces, that the minimum wage should be based on all cost of living factors. We pay good money to the United States Department of Labor's Bureau of Labor Statistics researchers to find out and figure out what the cost of living is all across the United States and the different regions. There's no reason why any worker should have to work for less than what the cost of living is. That's something that's a very, very basic element of what economic justice amounts to. And, you know, there's a number of people that will agree with that, but they will not state that because they know that it's an unpopular view to say that the minimum wage should be tied to the all cost of living factors. This could be done legislatively, and the minimum wage could be recalculated quarterly, right along with all these facts and figures that are accumulated by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And the only reason that isn't done is because they want to keep insisting that they have the right to pay people a poverty wage. I crisscrossed Canada and met with a lot of labor leaders in Canada. And in Canada, labor takes an important position, I believe, a position that we should be taking here in this country. And what labor leaders tell the government of Canada is that if you're going to have these miserly minimum wages, then the employer should be doing the work themselves and not expecting people to work for poverty wages. And I think this is something very basic and elemental. These employers should be told to do the work themselves if they don't want to pay people a real living wage.
Right, exactly. I'm going to get in a little bit into the breakdown that you have right here, Alan. And as I mentioned, I live right here in California in Riverside County. And when you consider the cost of living, even if you live in some areas of this county, which Hemet is a lot more, the cost of living is somewhat lower when you look at the cost of, like, housing. You can always ride on public transportation, but you can have a car that's paid for. But Let's say, for instance, you don't even have the car that's paid for. You don't even have a car. You're riding the bus. But if you're making $10 an hour, you're receiving approximately $1,700 a month. When you consider $10 an hour, you still have to realize that you're going to have to pay tax on that, which your net, you're probably going to have somewhere around $1,300, maybe around $1,350. Then you have rent. Let's say, for instance, you do move in that community, which I just mentioned, either Lake Elsinore, or you move in the city of Hemet. Many of us have heard of the city of Compton. Forget Compton, because you won't be able to live in Compton for no $650 a month. Yeah, you can't even live in many parts of central Los Angeles, almost impossible, for $650 a month. But let's look at some of these areas. Rent, $650. Let's look at bus fare, or if you have to pay for gasoline for your vehicle. Let's be very modest and say another $150 right there. Now we're down to $550 right there. You have to put in phone and utilities, whether it's a cell phone or a phone that's in your home, and that's going to come somewhere around $150 a month. Now we're down to $400 a month. And then you have to eat, figuring another $200 right there. And I'm just looking at some of these things that you have presented right here, Alan. We're down to $200 a month. We still haven't included if you go into college for college tuitions, the cost of Obamacare, which we know that's going to be a real cost that families are looking at. Forget about if you have a family where you have kids, sending kids to daycare or sending them to school. And remember, Alan, we only have $200 that's still left. How do you take care of that?
Well, it's very hard for
I'm looking at what you presented
people.
There. And I can't see it, Alan. Maybe you can explain it.
Well, I think it's even worse than what you're saying, Stuart. You know, you're using the $1,700 figure. I think you're basing that on 40 hours a week, right?
That's full time. That's full time.
The fact of the matter is, most of the people, and there's all kinds of facts to back this up, most of the people that are working at these low wages of the minimum
part-time.
Wage, they're part-time employees, and they're lucky if they get 24 to 32 hours a week.
Exactly.
If you work for Walmart, a lot of places across the country, Walmart is only paying the minimum wage anywhere from $7.25 to $7.80 an hour, and especially in the southern states where they employ tens of thousands of people. And they don't let these people work but 28 to 30 hours because they don't want to pay them any benefits. Some
right,
of them, they're lucky they get 32 hours. And you cannot buy the food for your family to eat if you work at Walmart, and the clothes to put on your kids' backs and pay the rent on what you make at Walmart. This is a disgrace. There's something drastically wrong when you work at a place like Walmart and you can't buy the food you need every week to feed your family with that
mm-hmm.
job. You know, and there's literally
that
thousands and thousands
yeah.
of people across this country in that situation. I worked at Walmart myself. And as a single person, it was hard for me to make ends meet with rent and food and the cost of transportation. You know, just those three things, it's almost impossible. That's why Walmart gives everybody a credit card when they first hire you. So you buy everything you need on credit, and then you're in debt to the company, you know. And it's that same old thing, just like, you know, the company store. That's what Walmart is. They're forcing people into debt to them for working for them.
Right. And I might mention, you have six of the wealthiest individuals on the planet work there for that company.
Exactly. And
And what was that, Ellen?
Well, exactly. And the Walton family, they've amassed a massive amount of wealth on the backs of paying people poverty wages. Without those poverty wages, they would not be the billionaires that they are today.
You have a gentleman here, and I won't mention his name, but he said he works the overnight shift at the Walmart store and lives in a garage with his wife and two children, told the Huffington Post, if I had a higher wage, we would be able to rent an apartment. I have to live from paycheck to paycheck. And he's living in a garage, I mean, and working for Walmart. And that's the situation, Alan, that we have with hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people that are working throughout this country that are working just at the minimum wage. So even if you increase it where they're working full-time, they're still in the same situation where they're having to live with someone else, and they're not able to take care of their basic fundamental needs as a family. So
right. One thing Walmart had been doing for a long time, and maybe you remember this, I was the one that exposed it and notified the news media, but Walmart was bringing in crews from the Eastern European countries, from Poland and Czechoslovakia and Hungary, to clean their stores after hours. And they were paying them less than the minimum wage. They were working them 12 and 14 hours a day. And they were making them pay rent to live in some of the worst dilapidated housing imaginable. And they would have 10, 12 people living in these old homes and charging them $500, $600 a month rent. And then they put them to work in their stores, sweeping and mopping the floors and waxing the floors. And they weren't even paying them the minimum wage.
These are people that they were bringing out from outside the country? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, they were bringing crews in from outside the country, making people think that they were getting...
That was illegal, correct?
Right. But the thing is, they got away with it, essentially. But this is the way they operate. They were bringing in crews even from El Salvador and some of the Latin American countries to do this work, and they were housing them like this. And, they had been doing this for years. I just happened to find out about it because I sat down and started eating lunch with some of the people and asking them what was going on, and they started telling me about it. And I got a hold of news reporters and told them about it, and it became a big scandal. And Walmart was forced to stop that. But, this is the kind of dirty things that the company has done.
And I'm looking right here also in this article. I'm just kind of looking at bits and pieces of what you mentioned, how you say Wall Street, in this article that you had written, Wall Street select politicians to talk about jobs, 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 when their hidden agenda is really profit, profit, profit.
Right, and that's exactly what it is, because, like I said, minimum wage and poverty wage jobs are,
they go hand in hand.
The employer. And
exactly.
what we need in this country is what was advocated in 1945 by Congressman Wright Patman, who called for a full employment act that made the president of this country and the United States Congress responsible for attaining and maintaining full employment. At the time in 1945, unemployment was only about 2%, and they could have accomplished this very easily. But after the United States Senate passed this, Wall Street ganged up on the House and started its attack on labor, and the 1945 Full Employment Act was defeated. So, this is a watermark in U.S. Labor history where the real repression started against the working class after World War II. Workers came back to this country thinking that they were going to make great advances because they had fought for democracy and for, the rights of people. And they thought they were going to come back to this country after having defeated Hitler, and they were going to win some, pretty decent living conditions here, and that their standard of living would be higher. Now, the British working class, they won a lot of these things in 1945. But here in the United States, the working class faced very vicious attacks, and the working class wasn't able to accomplish what the British working class accomplished.
Now, I'm looking at this. Tell us a little bit about this letter that you had written to the editor on minimum wage. And I think you had dated this on the 24th. That was another article. And actually, it received a reply in this article. It was it was something in regards to what you had received back, a response from the AFL-CIO. Could you just share a little bit about that post that you had done in regards to minimum wage, Alan?
Yes, Are you talking about the letter to Northern Light Region?
This is one of the most heated and controversial topics
okay.
that will come up before the new session of the Minnesota state legislation will be around minimum wage and what the minimum wage should be. Presently, minimum wage is a miserable wage at $6.15 an hour. So that was a letter that you had that you had sent out and responded to, and I just want you to share a little bit about that information that you had included in that letter.
I was just notified by the
$6.15 an hour. Did I read that wrong?
No, that's right. I was just notified by the editor of the Northern Light newspaper that my letter is going to be published this week. But Minnesota's minimum wage is a pathetically miserly minimum wage of $6.15 an hour. And it's even lower. What Minnesota politicians have done for what they call the smaller businesses, they made the minimum wage even lower. And so some workers are getting like $5 an hour. Some people that work in restaurants and everything, they have an even lower minimum wage based on that they're supposed to get these great tips and everything. And, you know, this has to end. And Minnesota politicians, what they're doing is they're playing a game, a political game, at the expense of working people. Now, Tom Bach, who is a leader of the state senate here in Minnesota, is a big shot in the Minnesota Building and Construction Trades Unions, where he used to be a leader of an elected leader.
Mm-hmm.
And he is fighting with the governor. The governor wants a minimum wage of around $9 an hour. The governor is a billionaire. He's the heir to the fortune of the Dayton Hudson Target store empire. And he wants a higher minimum wage than Tom Bach, who's supposed to be a labor leader, who's complaining and crying that if we raise the minimum wage to $9 and something an hour, it's going to hurt the hospitality industry. Now, the hospitality industry, like I said before, there are two billionaires from Minnesota on the Forbes 400 billionaire list, and they've made their billions on paying people poverty wages in the housekeeping and attending bar and everything else. And, you know, this has to end. And these politicians, in the last session, the governor argued with Tom Bach, and the leader of the House was arguing with both of them. These are all Democrats, and they used their arguments between each other as an excuse not to do anything to raise the minimum wage. They left the minimum wage. Here's the Democratic Farmer Labor Party, which is supposed to be a representative of labor, fighting amongst themselves
mm-hmm.
as to what the minimum wage should be. And their fight was a circus because the whole fight was intended to not raise the minimum wage at all, because all of them wanted to keep a poverty minimum wage. None of them really want to raise it. And, you know, obviously the Republicans have had a field day with this. Many Republicans here in Minnesota are calling for the elimination of the minimum wage. They don't think that there should be any minimum wage. So,
right.
You know, we've got a real fiasco and a farce and a circus going on here at the expense of working people. There are thousands and thousands of working class families here in Minnesota right now that are making poverty wages. One of these big stores, Menards, opened up on the Iron Range here in Minnesota. The Iron Range is one of the most heavily unionized communities in Minnesota. Menards was allowed to open up. They pay people $8.25 an hour. Most of the people aren't even getting 14 hours a week of work. And they give them just enough work to get these people off of unemployment compensation so they don't have to pay them unemployment. And then they consider these people working. And there are people losing their homes left and right. Menards hired hundreds of people to work in this huge store that they built on the Iron Range in Virginia, Minnesota, and they're paying people this poverty wage. And the guy that owns Menards, I forget his name, but he's another billionaire, he's made his wealth off of poverty wages. And they work these people like you wouldn't believe. Women were complaining that they were being kicked in their butt by supervisors and told that they weren't working fast enough, you know. This kind of harassment and intimidation when people are
making... Sounds like the 20s and 30s.
Yeah, exactly. And Menards on the Iron Range might even be facing a lawsuit over this intimidation and harassment of women. So it's, you know, it's really a serious situation. And here in Minnesota, Minnesota is recognized as one of the most progressive states in the nation, largely on the basis of the Farmer Labor Party, which was merged with the Democratic Party. But because of the work that was done by the Farmer Labor Party, you know, working people made some headway. But once it was merged with the Democratic Party, it became just a total corrupt party, and now it's serving the interests of the business community. Here we have the leaders of the Democratic Party here in Minnesota, the House, the Senate, and the governor, all Democrats, ganging up on working people to force a poverty wage down their throats, when they should be talking about attaching the minimum wage to cost of living, and they refuse to do that.
Well, today we have Alan Mackey. He's joining the program once again, and today we're discussing a very important topic that affects millions and millions of working people across the nation. And our discussion is based on minimum wage. Who does it benefit? Who does it hurt? Now, Alan, just share with our listeners just a bit about who does it benefit? I mean, because we can see that Wall Street has taken off like lightning within the last few years. They say we have an economy that hasn't bounced back, but when we look at the titans on Wall Street has bounced back big time. So they say the economy, we're barely coming out of the recession, but the only ones that haven't come out of the recession are working people. So who does it benefit? And when we talk about minimum wage, and who does it really hurt? Discuss that a little bit.
I think we have to be clear on this. Minimum wage legislation does help the working class if the minimum wage is a real living wage. But that's
does $7 an hour help anyone?
What?
Does $7 increase in minimum wage to like $7.50 an hour, does it really help anyone?
Well, to the extent that it doesn't allow employers to pay any less, it helps. Because employers would be paying much less than the $7.25 if there wasn't a minimum wage at all. But, you know, we have to look at the facts, and we have to say that the minimum wage is nothing like the cost of living factors that we're people cannot live on this minimum wage, and this is what has to be fought for. I mean, this is basic human decency and economic justice. Elizabeth Warren, U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, I saw a YouTube video of her commenting in the United States Senate, and she says that if the minimum wage had kept pace with inflation since the 60s, the minimum wage would be just over $22 an hour right now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this whole idea that workers should have to work for a minimum wage is just wrong, too, because the minimum wage should be used not just to make sure that the workers get paid a just wage, but it should be used to raise the livelihoods of working and the standard of living of working people, too. That is not even being considered. But it has not even kept pace with inflation. I mean, this when you consider $7.25 an hour as compared to what Elizabeth Warren says it would be with inflation factored in at over $22 an hour.
$22 an hour.
Yeah, the difference, what happened with the difference? The difference went into the pockets of the employers. And this is a massive amount of wealth. Since the 60s, we're talking about over 50 years now of the minimum wage not ever keeping up with inflation. And every single dollar that has been robbed from working people has gone directly into the pockets of these employers and some of the largest businesses and corporations in this country. So, you know, what really bugs me is the unions will not push for the minimum wage to be kept up with the cost of living. And, you know, there's a number of union contracts right now that are far below the $22 an hour. And this is something that Richard Trumka does not want to confront, nor do any of these 57 members sitting on the executive council of the AFL-CIO. They do not want to confront the whole idea and the issue that they have not been able to wage a fight to maintain the standard of living of the working class in this country. You know, you have people in the Service Employees Union that are working under union contracts for $10, $11, $12 an hour, sometimes less. And this is a total disgrace. It means that the union movement has not been willing to stand up and defend the livelihoods and the standard of living of the workers that they represent. And this is the thing that's being hidden, and this is the thing that Richard Trumka and these so-called labor leaders do not want to talk about. And what
and
they don't
just,
want to talk about it is that they're so well tied in with Wall Street that they're afraid to discuss it.
Oh, yeah.
I every week I get reports from the FFL-CIO of their investment portfolio where they invest the pension funds from workers in all these corporations, the very corporations that are paying people, you know, these poverty wages. This is a disgrace. That money should, from those pension funds, should be going into a public bank someplace, and that money should be used to build people homes for the homeless and to establish a healthcare system and to do what working people need. And they should see to it that the workers are paid real living wages that are working in those programs that are benefiting from the pension funds. It's as simple as that, and this is something that they're hiding. We're talking about billions and billions of dollars in union pension funds that are going to subsidize these very poverty wages.
Exactly. You know, one of the other things when you were talking about Elizabeth Warren, I look at another article that I was reading, and it says, does $9 or $10 sound high? Consider that if the minimum wage had merely kept up with worker productivity gains since 1968, it would have been more than $16.50 today. $16.50, that's if it had just kept up with worker productivity gains. You have to realize that when you're suppressing this income, you have to understand where that shift goes to. And
right.
The other thing that I see is they say, who's leading the charge against a minimum wage increase today? And then it says the restaurant industry, which includes such fast food mega companies as McDonald's, Yum Brands, KFC, Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, and we can include Walmart in this group, the ones that are fighting increasing minimum wage. But what is the shift is they suppress the minimum wage, and then it goes into the profits for these companies. And, Alan, we see this across the country. I even see it in the industry that I'm working in. I work in the automobile industry, and you can see that how people are working for minimum wage. Here just recently, the company that I work for here in San Diego County, they had one person which she was working for a little over $12 an hour. So what they did is they said, well, you know, we need to cut your hours back to $8.50 an hour. So she was going to take a $4 decrease in wages. But in addition to that, they were going to increase her workload and told her that she had to work like hours in the evening. So they were completely just destroying her entire life. She quit, and then they hired two more people to replace her. They're working part-time. So basically what they did is they got rid of one full-time worker that was doing good work, and they brought in two part-time workers that work primarily during the evenings, and they work on the weekends, but they're not working full-time hours. But, Alan, this is going on across the country, everywhere.
Well, exactly. When I worked at Walmart, I worked with people that were working two and three jobs, and they still weren't able to survive. But a number of people would barely be able to go home and get 2 or 3 hours sleep before they had to go to their other job, and it was literally killing people. I worked with people that were literally they were going nuts. They had to go see psychiatrists and everything because their life was just a shambles. And I don't think people quite realize, you know, they talk about people like Robert Reich and some of these people talk about people working two and three jobs. They recognize what's going on, but they don't recognize and they don't understand the toll that it takes on a human life to have to work two or three of these poverty wage-paying jobs. You know, they were talking about people working 14, 16, sometimes 18 hours a day, sometimes 5, 6, and even 7 days a week at these jobs. And this takes a terrible toll on a human being when they have to work like this. It's just terrible. I worked at in a sweatshop called Lillian Vernon as a sewing machine operator in the Meistergram department.
Mm-hmm.
And we were forced to work 12 hours a day, 6 and 7 days a week. And it got to the point where the plant manager took our stools away because he said he was doing it for a safety precaution because he was worried that if we fell asleep, we would get hurt. And he said, as long as you're standing up, you won't fall asleep. This is the mentality of the people that are running this country and the corporations in this country. And this goes on, you know, there's these sweatshops. Lillian Vernon employed between 4,000 and 5,000 people during its peak season. And there are sweatshops like this all throughout the South. And people are working, you know, in industries that have moved out of Detroit or even industries in the auto that have moved from Canada down to places like Tennessee, and the people are working in unbearable conditions, 12, 13, and 14 hours a day, sometimes 5 and 6 and even 7 days a week. Try doing that. I urge anybody, try doing this and try to maintain any semblance of a life working those kinds of hours. And yet we have tens of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people in this country working like this. This is a disgrace.
Today, I just want to our listeners, once again, I want to mention that we have Alan Mackey. He's joining our program once again. And today we're discussing a very important topic that that many working families can relate to, minimum wage. Who does it benefit and who does it hurt? And, Alan, again, thanks for joining the program.
Yeah. Workers that I work with, Stuart, in the casino industry and in Indian gaming industry, many of these workers are forced to work for minimum wage and sometimes under minimum wage.
Exactly.
They're forced to work in the smoke-filled casinos.
That's horrible.
12,
I know it is here
day,
in California.
5, 6, and 7 days a week. And this takes a terrible toll on a person's health, too, working in these smoke-filled casinos. People don't understand that some of the casino patrons come in and they'll sit there and gamble for a couple hours or 4 or 5 hours, and they'll leave. And they say, well, it's not that bad. But for a person that has to work day in and day out in these smoke-filled casinos and then get a poverty wage and then be told that if you start coughing, you're fired because they don't want to pay the health benefits. You know, this is what's going on with hundreds of thousands of people in this Indian gaming industry who work in this industry without any rights.
And that's a good point, Alan. That's a good point that you just brought up. I mean, these people are working in an environment that is completely harmful to their health. And you know, they're doing it at poverty wages on top of that. But let's just think about their health as opposed to their income. Both are bad, but when you're talking about the income that they're making, that's horrible. Alan, we're going to get into a few other things, and before we complete our program today, I'm going to discuss a couple of things. You had mentioned about the concept of a 21st Century Full Employment Act for peace and prosperity, so we're going to talk a little bit about that. I'm just going to go off on a tangent just for a few minutes. When you consider, like, during the time of the Vietnam War, and during the times of wars, even when we look at World War One and the Second World War here in this country, how they had full employment. People don't remember here in California, there were an abundance of jobs. You had aerospace, you had the automobile industry, everything was booming. Alan, there were so many jobs you would go to. Many of our young listeners can't relate to this. You would go to the unemployment office. You would quit a job just because you didn't want the job anymore. Yeah. And you would go to an unemployment office, and for every job you looked at, they probably had like around 5 or 6 jobs up there that were available for, you know, whether you wanted to work full-time or part-time, but jobs were available. It was an abundance of jobs. But you had to realize that war creates a booming economy, but it's doing it at the cost of human lives. But Alan, we can, the monies that we spend on war, we can also have an economy for peace as well, jobs for peace. And
right. I'm not sure what happened during World War One on the economy and jobs, but World War Two.
At the end of the war, once the U.S. got involved in the war, people were still working at poverty wages then, but it created jobs. It created jobs, especially for the steel industry at that time.
World War II was somewhat different because we were in a deep
World War
depression.
II was extremely different.
And without World War II, we never would have pulled out of that depression. And the thing is, the economy had started a boom at the end of the World War II, and we had an unemployment rate of 2% and sometimes even less, the national unemployment rate. And
They show as a result of the war, the Second World War, that the economy had only received had a benefit of 28% recovery by the time we went into the war. By the time the war was over, we were completely, the nation had had a complete recovery from the Depression. And that's what war did. But war is not the answer.
Right. But the thing that I was going to point out, though, Stuart, at the end of World War II, labor was on the move, and wages were being forced up because when you have low unemployment, it tends to cause wages to rise because people aren't worried about losing their jobs, so they'll fight for a higher wage. And the labor unions were on the move, and wages are being forced up. Wall Street would not tolerate a full employment economy because Wall Street needs a massive unemployment in order to pressure all wages down. And this is one reason why the Full Employment Act of 1945 was defeated. And instead of the 1945 Full Employment Act, they passed the 1946 Full Employment Act, which the main thing with that was that it created this Council of Economic Advisors. And the first head of the Council of Economic Advisors was fired because he advocated for a full employment economy. Now, what Wall Street wanted was massive unemployment in order to push the rising wages down. And they used unemployment as a lever to push wages down. If you read Alan Greenspan's book, he even admits that unemployment is used to keep wages down. And this is the main factor that you've always got in a capitalist economy. You always got this struggle between the owners of industries and the workers. And workers are going to fight for a higher wage, and the owners of these industries are going to fight for a lower wage because that pushes their profits up. And this is the main struggle that goes on in a capitalist economy. And we're going to have to realize that. And this is what's going to have to be taken into consideration. And we're going to have to find an alternative to capitalism. I think it's socialism. But we need to start talking, in my opinion, we need to start talking about socialism right along with talking about the kinds of reforms that we need.
Exactly. Alan, I'm going to just touch on a few things in regards to some bullet points. Just recently, I should say several months ago, I was on the John Stossel program. One of the questions that he presented to me was in regards to how much income was enough. But I'm going to ask you that same question. When you look at hourly income, How much is enough? Because he started throwing out some ridiculous stuff. Should it be $75? Should it be $100 an hour? That was completely ridiculous. But how much per hour is enough?
Well, I think that working people would generally agree that what's enough as a bare minimum is to meet cost of living. And if we could create a society where everybody had a wage that met the cost of living, we'd be living in a pretty good society. And I would also point out that wages aren't everything. You know, we have to consider that if we had more universal social programs, like a national public health care system, if we had a national public child care system, well, that right there eliminates the need for a much higher wage. If you want to look at it like that, if we want to be kind to the capitalists, then create these universal social programs which provide these services that people will not have to pay for. And that will create employment, too. So, you know, we've got to look at that. But on the other hand, you know, when we look at people that, you know, what are people entitled to? People are entitled to anything that they can win. And because this is a struggle between labor and capital. And I don't think that we should set a limit and say that working people are only entitled to such and such a wage. You know, we don't say to the capitalist, you're only entitled to such and such a profit. So, you know, living under capitalism, this struggle, it's only normal if the struggle is going to go on and workers are entitled to whatever they can win. If workers can win $100 an hour wage, more power to them. But I think you and I both know that most workers will never win that under in a capitalist society. But we
exactly.
can win. We can win a living wage. That is winnable, and that is something that can come right straight from the profits that have been derived through the exploitation of labor by these corporate people. On
now,
Wall Street,
one of
the
other
the
things
profits
that,
are there.
That, one of the things I always encounter when I start talking about increasing the minimum wage, Alan, is the argument around increasing the minimum wage will result in inflation. How would you address that concern? I always,
well,
as soon as I see increased minimum wage, I always hear that, well, it's going to just, inflation is just going to go crazy. But how would you address that?
Well, that's been an argument for a long time. I think when we look at it scientifically and realistically, anybody can see that wages do not cause inflation. Wages go up in order to meet the higher cost of living. And it's this drive for corporate profits. And in war, war is the main cause of inflation in our modern capitalist society. Because if you look at what is required for a military, all this fuel and everything that goes into the military, the gas, when you have this kind of pressure on resources, that is what forces inflation to rise. And the more our economy becomes militarized, the more inflation that we'll have. A capitalist society normally has some amount of inflation, but inflation is way out of control in this country, and anybody that goes shopping from week to week can see that the prices are rising in the grocery store. You know, we see home heating fuels out of sight, and that's because the military gobbles up everything, and they these corporations figure, oh, if we can get this price out of the military, we can get it out of the public too. And so that's the main cause of inflation in our society. And the other cause of inflation is when profits rise, when workers can no longer buy back what they have produced, we see an inflation set in at the same time. And as the corporations force prices up, that's what causes inflation. It's prices going
right.
up, being forced to go up by the corporations who are seeking greater profits that are, you know, a driving force of inflation.
In
wages.
In my opinion, inflation
is
created
prices.
By greed.
Exactly. Wages only chase prices. Working people are not greedy. Working people,
no, they're not.
If most working people in this country would be very satisfied if they were getting what Elizabeth Warren said the minimum wage should be of $22 to $24 an hour. I don't know of many working people that would complain a lot if they were getting those kinds of wages. But the fact is, most government employees don't make those kinds of wages. Most people in private industry do not make those kinds of wages, not even if they're working under a union contract. Very few union contracts that we see have working people getting $22 to $24 to $26 an hour. The auto industry, the top tier in the auto industry, is getting around $30 an hour. Some people in the building trades, yeah, you can point to people that are getting $40, $60, $70 an hour working heavy equipment. But this is a very small minority of the working class. And, you know, I say more power to them. But they should be concerned about the other workers that aren't doing as well. And the reason they should be concerned is because the more people that are unemployed and the more people getting poverty wages, pressures their own wages down too.
Now, Alan, and you know how I feel about Walmart, so this question to you is basically just airing my opinion about Walmart. For our listeners, I just want to make it public that I do not like Walmart. So, Alan, we as a nation, when you look at the global economy, and when we let people work to produce our goods, you know, in other countries for less than $2 per hour. Alan, is that not hypocritical that we can actually step foot in companies like, do business with companies like Walmart?
Well, I think that, you know, with the Walmarts, whether it's Walmart or Target, I don't really see
Target.
Walmart as any worse than most other companies. You know, their bottom line is their profits. I think we got to encourage Walmart workers to begin to organize and to, you know, get a union contract signed. Walmart is the largest employer in the world. And
right.
For Walmart not to be organized, there's something drastically wrong with the labor movement. Walmart should have been organized years ago. And
I agree with you. It's a lot of that, the responsibility falls on the labor movement, where they
right.
should be able to organize people to understand. And when I say organize, and also educate the public what this is costing, not only workers here in this country, but workers abroad as well. That's what you're saying, correct?
Correct. I mean, workers in China that work at Walmart, they make less than $2 an hour. And
right, exactly.
I've talked to people that work in Walmart in some of the Latin American countries, and, you know, they're making substantially less than what would be comparable to a dollar an hour. And, you know, everything has to be considered in relation to cost of living and when it comes to workers' wages. And, you know, we can see the terrible conditions that people are living in Latin America and in Africa. Walmart is spreading all over the world. It's the largest employer in the world. And there is no reason why there shouldn't be an international union taking on Walmart. And this is what, you know, progressives and leftists should be pushing for, is an international union where all Walmart workers are getting a wage that's a real living wage. And if we don't have something to use as a rule to measure what that is, you know, then it's hard to fight. And that's where cost of living, to talk about cost of living and standard of living is very important. Because this gives us something to compare wages in the United States and in Africa and South America and in China and the Philippines. It gives us a standard to compare one's wages to. There's no reason why somebody in one country should be getting a living wage and workers in another country shouldn't be getting a living wage. The fact is, with Walmart, no workers are getting a living wage. None. You know, if you make $10 or $12 an hour at Walmart, and you have to work there quite a while to get a wage like that, there are very few workers that are at Walmart, even if they've worked there 10 and 12, 15 years, that are getting $12 an hour. This is a disgrace. You know, this is the largest corporation in the world, where the entire family is on the billionaires list, and then they got the nerve to pay people these poverty wages. This is... something that, you know, there should be a massive, massive campaign
right.
to organize Walmart.
Alan, I mentioned to you recently, I was talking about the political party that I'm a member of, which is the Socialist Party USA, and also I mentioned at one time I was a member of the Peace and Freedom Party. But the Socialist Party USA, SPUSA, they call for a minimum wage of $15 per hour indexed to the cost of living. And they believe that this shouldn't be anything that's incremental. This is something that needs to be done now and by this Congress. But when you look at $15 an hour, is this something that Congress, the U.S. Congress, should be moving where it's legislation that will take effect across the nation or state by state? What is your opinion about $15 per hour indexed to the cost of living and doing something like that now, today?
Well, $15 an hour would certainly be better than what most people in this country make that are working at the minimum wage today. But like I said, I think we have to focus on cost of living and get a minimum wage that's tied to to all cost of living factors as calculated by the United States Department of Labor's Bureau of Labor Statistics. And this is the only fair way to set the minimum wage, and it can be done. This is what Frances Perkins, who was FDR's Secretary of Labor, had in mind. She suggested, you know, this is way back in the 1930s, that eventually the minimum wage should be tied to the cost of living. And this is what I think we should be struggling for. You know, I would support raising the minimum wage literally any amount, anything is better than nothing. To raise the minimum wage to $8 an hour is better than nothing, one might say. To raise it to $9 or $10 or $15 an hour is certainly better than what we have now. But if we're going to fight for something, let's fight to tie the minimum wage to cost of living.
Right.
Now, this is just my opinion. And this has been the opinion of the labor movement in Canada for the last 20 years or so, that the minimum wage has to be tied to cost of living. And this is something that the New Democratic Party in Canada has been supporting for a very long time, and I think we got to look at the same thing here in this country. Because otherwise, you know, if you say $15 an hour, Governor Dayton here in Minnesota says, well, you know, $9.50 an hour is not so bad. And Elizabeth Warren is saying, well, it would have been $22 to $24 an hour had it kept up with inflation, but you know, the president is proposing $10 an hour or $9.50 an hour, so that's not so bad either. And when we talk about these figures and we're not putting it in relation to cost of living, we're sort of defeating ourselves. So we can say that, you know, $15 gets us closer, and I think that there probably won't be too many people complaining that are getting $7.25 an hour now if their wages were doubled. So, you know, that is an improvement, and we've got to fight for those kinds of improvements. But at the same time, we have to realize the real fight is for a minimum wage that's tied to cost of living. And then when we start talking about that, that's when we'll start getting closer to the $15 an hour and the $20 an hour for a minimum wage. Until we start talking about cost of living, we're not going to get above $8, $9, $10 an hour for the minimum wage.
And, Alan, this is going to be a two-part segment. We're going to pick this up at another time because we only have two more minutes, and I'm not even halfway through what we need to talk about. We need to talk about the 21st Century Full Employment Act for Peace and Prosperity. We're going to talk about how part of that act is health care for 15 million jobs, child care, 5 million jobs, WPA, CCC, CETA, building homes, it just goes on. Retirement set at 55, reducing the work week to 32 hours. I mean, it's a very detailed list, and we're going to get into that in each segment of that and explain how much of this will create jobs. In addition to that, in the second part of the series, Alan, we're going to talk about full employment at a living wage, and talk about what the new Progressive Alliance, what they have put out there for the public, so we can see that full employment is possible. But we're going to do this in the second segment, just in those two areas, because when we see the jobs that can be created and how good-paying jobs can be created, we just need to have a different agenda from what we have there in Washington, D.C. Alan, right now I'd like for you to just take just around 30 seconds just to let our listeners know how they can reach you, and we'll be looking forward to having you back on in a couple of weeks to discuss the rest of this important information. Alan, how can our listeners reach you and read much of what you put out on the Internet?
Well, they can reach me on my telephone number, 218-386-2432, or they can Google my name, Alan Mackey, A-L-A-N-M-A-K-I, and they'll come across my blog with all my contact information on it. I look forward to talking to people about all these problems, Stuart. And, you know, I'm appreciative of the opportunity to talk about these problems on your program. And, you know, one solution is to elect people like yourself to public office, and that's what we got to begin to push for.
And I appreciate it, Alan, and people are listening to you. And thanks again for joining the Socialist Insight, and we look forward to having all of our listeners to join us next week. Have a good night. Thank you, Alan. Thank you,
yep,
Ruth.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Good night, everyone.